April the 11th, 1989. This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary meeting in 453 at the State Capitol. It's 5:30 in the evening. We're having a public hearing on the following bills. Senate Bill 45, 46, 47. Work session on the following bills. 121, 122, 356, 406, 562. House Bill 2125. House Bill 2126. House Bill 2355.
It is sort of amazing to think that we're being pressed by not only other committees, but all of us are still the same problem, that we can't get a quorum here with their full attention because we're called off with other committees. But I would like to get started for those of us that are here and start on the public hearing of Senate Bill 45, 46, and 47. There are three of us here who will move ahead on that. And let's see who signed up. Then when we get into work session, we'll try to round up the appropriate members and gather enough yes votes. Right? Well, we got to do. We got the deal is that Brenneman's voting no down in Ag Committee, so he can be up here voting yes. And Springer probably vote no up here, and he's voting yes down there. So we'll make a trade.
Exchange my no votes for his yes votes. That's it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Down let's there. Have.
Your no vote's not going to do any good down there.
Tony DiLorenzo is here from DMV, and Rick McCormick is here from the Governor's Task Force on DUI. District Court Judge from Linn County. Both of you come on up and start with Senate Bill 45, please.
And in your folders, you'll find written testimony from Mr. DiLorenzo. Okay.
Senator Cohen, I apologize for not submitting my written testimony prior to this time. I have brought something with me. I'm here only on Senate Bill 45.
Good. If you just make sure we get your name so the clerk who's taking the minutes can...
I'm Judge Rick McCormick.
Great.
I'm a district court judge from Linn County. I'm also a member of the Governor's Task Force on DUII. We are supporting this bill as well. This bill basically makes amendments to ORS 809-420. That's the statute that sets out the suspension periods which follow from convictions for major traffic offenses. There are two schedules in 809-420, one of them dealing with like reckless driving, attempting to elude, those sorts of things. The other one, Schedule 2, dealing with DUII. The problem and what Senate Bill tries to remedy is this particular wording of that statute. In a sense, the statute as it reads now talks about the format is that on a first conviction for the other major traffics, there's a 90-day suspension. On a second conviction within 5 years, there's a 1-year suspension. And on a third conviction, there's a 3-year suspension. On DUII, on a first conviction, it's 1 year. On a second or subsequent, it's a 3-year suspension. The problem is that the wording of the statute reads for example, on DUII, it reads as follows. 3 years for a second or subsequent offense where the second or subsequent offense was committed within 5 years of a prior conviction. This works out great if you have a situation where you have an arrest and a conviction, say in 1985, and then an arrest and a conviction in 1988. On the first one, the defendant would receive a 1-year suspension. On the second one, he or she would receive a 3-year suspension. The enhancement would work in that situation. The problem with the wording prior conviction is this. Where there's an offense, say committed January 1st, the defendant gets an attorney, tries to postpone the matter, and he still hasn't gone to trial, say in July. He picks up another offense in July. He's then subsequently tried and convicted of both offenses. In that situation, the way this statute presently reads, he would have two one-year suspensions, which would run concurrently. The reason that the second conviction would not get the enhanced suspension is because at the time of the second offense, there was not a prior conviction. There was a prior offense, but it hadn't been converted to conviction yet. The wording as the amendment here simply makes it so that it's a second conviction within a five-year period of the offense. And so in a sense, the enhancement would apply equally to the second example as it would in the first. This is only a situation where it clarifies the statute and provides fairness, in my opinion. Assuming that you believe that a second offense for the same matter should have an enhanced suspension period, and I certainly agree with that, and so does the governor's task force, certainly then this bill makes sense, in my opinion. Have I made myself clear?
I think so. I'm not sure that we're ready to explain it on the floor, but I guess have we brought in someone's offense that, how would you do it if they were actually cleared of something? I mean, you'd have to have.
Well, there would be no suspension. This talks about suspensions for convictions only.
Okay.
And so, as a practical matter, if the person was arrested and he or she was found not guilty, or the DA dismissed the matter, there would be no suspension under 809-420. So it wouldn't apply. It only applies to convictions. And so this is the mandatory one-year conviction after suspension after conviction, or a mandatory three-year suspension after a second or subsequent conviction. The change here only makes it so that in the situation where a person gets two or three offenses within a 6 or 8 month period and hasn't been convicted of anything yet, he would get enhanced suspensions, as we believe he should. The remainder of, and I'm sorry, is that?
Madam Chair.
Yes, please, sir.
Could you give us an example aside from the simultaneous conviction? I mean, that makes perfect sense. Are there other instances as well where this language is a problem?
I don't think so. We had this bill amended last session, and quite frankly, we fouled up and this language remained in it. It used to read, it said that if you had two convictions within a five-year period, what we were finding was that a person would be convicted in 85, they get another offense, and they drag their feet for a year, so the 5 years would run out. So we changed the language from conviction to offense, but then we fouled up and we said prior conviction. And so it only applies in that situation, and I think Mr. DiLorenzo ran some figures on it, and I think he can be much more informative than I am. It doesn't apply to an awful lot of people. This doesn't happen very often, but in the situations where it happens, it creates an unfairness as far as these people, because they're not getting the enhanced suspension periods.
I'll wait for Mr. DiLorenzo, because I have a question, but his honor doesn't need to have to answer it for me.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead, Tony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tony DiLorenzo from the Motor Vehicles Division, here in support of Senate Bill 45, which is our bill. We introduced it to close some loopholes in the DUI statutes and to try to make things more equitable. I think Judge McCormick has done an excellent job of explaining what we're up to in the first part of the bill with the change in how the suspension length is determined. There's something else going on, though, in the first part of the bill that you need to be aware of. When a person is convicted of DUI, they know that they're in trouble with us. And there's three things that they want to know. How long am I going to be suspended? How long do I have to wait for a hardship permit? Because you, the legislature, decided that repeat offenders should wait for a hardship permit. And finally, do I have to go on an alcohol treatment program as a condition for getting the hardship permit? Somehow over the years, the definition of repeat offender for each of those three different things, suspension length, waiting times, and alcohol treatment, are different. And it's driving people crazy. It's driving the alcohol evaluators crazy who are trying to advise these people what's going to happen to them. It's driving lawyers crazy. What we've got is, Judge McCormick has just described what the standard is for suspension length. The standard for hardship permit waiting times is number of convictions. With no, oh, by the way, it's 5 years. There's a five-year limit on the, as Judge McCormick explained, on suspension lengths, but there's no time limit on hardship permit waiting times for deciding who's a repeat offender. So it's convictions within, you know, a person's lifetime. As a practical matter, it's 10 years because that's all we're keeping on the computer. And for alcohol program approval, it's not convictions, it's number of suspensions. So the other thing that's going on in the bill is not only to change the way we decide who's a repeat offender for the purpose of suspension length, it makes it uniform and applies that same definition of repeat offender to suspension length, hardship waiting time, and alcohol program approval. So that once you know what the person's situation is with regard to DUI convictions, you can figure out what's going to happen to them without having to do a detailed analysis of a driving record. And if this isn't addressed, somebody could argue that we should be required to keep a lifetime driving record so that we can be enhancing these waiting times based on things that happened 25 years ago, and I don't think anybody wants that. And the 5 years, I think, is a pretty well-accepted standard. So that's part one of the bill.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
So the language you're proposing as a substitute for those three definitions is which?
It's on page one. It's in schedule one. It's at the bold face there, starting at line 16,
okay,
and at line 27. As Judge McCormick has pointed out, for consistency, we're applying that language also to some other major offenses.
So we're using the offense language rather than some of the alternatives.
Yeah, it's going to be offense-based. Yeah, we did a sample of 160 repeat offenders and found that about 12% of them are slipping through and being treated as first-time offenders for purposes of suspension. And you start taking, that doesn't sound like a lot, but you take 12% of, say, 2,000 people, and that's a lot that are slipping through and being treated as first when they're really repeat offenders.
Madam Chair?
I will.
Senator Brockman.
The bill aside, this is good. I get it. This is just cleaning everything up and bringing it in together so people know where they stand. But the question that I have about this enhanced suspensions and all this stuff, it seems to me that we're really not doing anything to keep these people off the road other than suspending their license. Have you got some evidence that indicates that all these suspensions and things are really keeping these people from driving?
Madam Chair, Senator Brockman, we have evidence, solid evidence, that people who we suspend get into fewer accidents and have fewer traffic violations. Okay, I won't pretend for a minute that they don't drive. In fact, we have evidence indicating that 50% or more may drive, but it's very seldom that you get a good control group to do any kind of analysis, because for constitutional reasons you have to treat everybody the same. But we had a little, I don't want to call it a foul up, but a little situation involving a change in the habitual offender law, which resulted in a bunch of folks not getting revoked as quickly as some other folks. So we had a ready-made control group, and we found that the habitual offenders the people that we revoked as habitual offenders had substantially overall fewer accidents and convictions, especially the ones that got the notice. There wasn't a whole lot of difference between the ones that didn't get the notice, but those that got the notice, substantially fewer accidents and convictions. So driving while suspended is a serious problem, and as I'm sure you and the other members of the committee are aware.
Tell me what you mean by got the notice, because if we're not giving everybody the notice, then why don't we give everybody the notice if that's
Madam Chair, we send all suspension and revocation notices to the person's address of record, you know, certified mail, return receipt requested. 50 on overall average, about 50% of the people actually sign the return receipt, and 50% the post office sends it back, returned, you know, unclaimed. Which is one of the reasons why we strongly support having the judges hand those, and that's And that's not much of an issue anymore. It's an issue with habitual offenders because we're the ones that are doing that revocation. But for DUI, it's not much of an issue anymore because the judges are now, we're well over 80%, I think, in the percentage of judges who are issuing the notices. And when a judge issues the notice right there in the courtroom, you know they received it. There's no doubt, there's no problem with proving driving while suspended. And that system is very effective. We're one of the things that we're experimenting with on habitual offenders, in fact, to help improve that is we're sending, because it doesn't cost us a lot of money, we're sending a second notice or planning to by first class mail so that, you know.
But isn't it worth a $15 petition to do service on something like this? I mean, supposedly these people are wrecking major havoc, and if you have some indication that those will actually get some attention as a follow-up, I guess I'm concerned that you haven't asked for that.
Madam Chair, as a matter of fact, a few years ago, back in the 1970s, there was a bill which became law which required us to use personal service. I believe it was sponsored by Bob's Messenger Service or some process server. In any event, we did that. We did that for a period of 2 years, and the result was that Bob's Messenger Service, or wherever we use, was no more effective
than the
mail, 50%. And it was 10 times as expensive. They just were no more effective in getting those notices to the customers, you know, that people weren't home and so forth. So it was actually no more or slightly less effective than mail and far more expensive.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yeah.
The study group thing that you referred to a minute ago, were you talking about the Thule problem? You meant the point that the chair raised that folks not getting notice was that?
No, it had, Madam Chair, Mr. Morris. No, it had nothing to do with Thule.
All right.
Okay.
What else? So that's all of Senate.
No,
what else
there's
the Senate there's let's a, get on to the rest there, of it.
Yeah, there's a little more in here. The other issue is hardship waiting times. There's a loophole in the current statute which says that if you've had to wait at all for a hardship permit as a result of a breath test failure or refusal, you don't have to wait at all as a result of a conviction for DUI. And so there's a lot of folks who are getting perhaps 90-day, 30-day waits as a result of breath test failures and refusals, who were then, because they've had to wait a little for that, are then escaping entirely the one-year wait that the legislature has mandated for a repeat DUI conviction. And we'd like to plug that loophole. Also, there's a little bit of an equity issue. Some 20% of people who are arrested for DUI in this state, incredibly, go to trial and are convicted before the implied consent suspension goes into effect. That is to say, they are arrested and convicted inside of 30 days, and so they're not available, you know, they don't get to use this loophole at all. So there's both an equity and an effectiveness issue. And what the bill provides for is it says that everybody waits for the full term, but they'll get credit served for the implied consent wait, so they don't have to, you know, the waits don't double up. So they don't get, they have to wait.
Where is that language specifically, if you'll note?
Madam Chair, that language specifically is on page 3 of the bill at subsections 5 and 6, lines.
Yeah, we can find them. I just need to get the right.
Right.
Okay. That's the end of what you've dealt with here so far, right? Okay. Please.
Senate Bill 46, also a DMV bill. This is a bill to adjust shall I say, an oversight when the motor vehicle code was substantially rewritten back in 1985. There are some convictions which the old code, the pre-1985 code, required to be reported to DMV, and the statutes inadvertently, when the change was made, eliminated those from the ones to be reported to DMV. You will find those listed on the last page of the attachment. Defective coupling device, dragging object on the highway, excessive trailer sway, failure to stop for scales, illegal operation of farm vehicles, illegal tires, improper combination of vehicles, leaking sifting load, no safety chain. The effect of this bill is once again to require courts to send to report those convictions to DMV so that they can go on the driving record. And this merely takes us back to where we were before 1985.
Okay, other questions?
Madam Chair, something's been driving me crazy. I'm on transportation, and all the testimony that we get in there is signed by David P. Mumaugh, and I'm beginning to wonder if there really is a David P. Mumaugh, because this one here, the testimony, is a statement prepared by Joan Plank, signed by Jim Hunter for David P. Mumaugh. There really is a David P. Mumaugh somewhere.
Madam Chair, Senator Brockman, you have my word on it, Senator.
All right, thank you.
Senator Hill.
I would just like to ask that you mean that these have been off of what should have been reported to you since 1985?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, yes. We have proposed this bill as soon as we discovered the oversight. We spent a lot of time and effort trying to make sure that there were no errors when the code was rewritten, but it was a massive effort and little things were bound to slip through. And we've come to you with this as soon as we were aware of it.
Okay, now I haven't looked at all of them, but you have bicycle racing.
Now that's the list of stuff that's still to be reported to us.
That still is reported?
Yes.
I'm sorry, good grief. Those are the convictions that the courts are not. There's two attachments. The first attachment is the ones that they're not supposed to give us, and the last one is the ones they're supposed to give us.
And they're sending you all this other stuff? The stuff on the first list, they're still...
No, they are not.
All right.
Yeah, that's fine and always has been. It's just that they were not sending us the stuff on the last page and should be. Actually, I think probably some courts didn't know that the law had changed, and I'm sure we've actually been receiving some of them.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, where's Jack? I guess we just have these scheduled for public hearing, don't we? It would be nice to move them, but we can't. Okay, Senate Bill 47.
Senate Bill 47. This is a bill designed to resolve two problems that occurred last session when conflicting bills passed. Section 1 of the bill, we had a problem when we passed a bill 2213 last session, which changed the word state to jurisdiction in a particular subsection of law. And then along came House Bill 3059, which reversed part of that. So we've got in one subsection of law, we have state in one place and jurisdiction in another place. And this bill simply makes everything consistent, standardizes on jurisdiction, which is what we believe to be legislative intent. In Section 2, we have another problem also created by 3059. House Bill 2449 established the Ignition Interlock Pilot Program. And the ignition interlock, as the committee may know, becomes a condition of a hardship permit. And the bill appropriately at that time made reference to ORS 811-175, which is driving while suspended. All driving while suspended was in that section, including driving while suspended for DUI, which is what you do when you drive out without your ignition interlock device. Well, then along comes House Bill 3059 and splits DWS, decriminalizes it and puts the criminal DWS in ORS 811-182, a whole new subsection of law. And so now we have driving without a ignition interlock device, referring us to 811-175, which is infraction driving while suspended. And it turns out these two bills were drafted by separate staff at legislative council. They can't agree. One thinks that the offense is an infraction. The other thinks the offense is a felony. We don't care what people think it is. It ought to be a felony, and that's what this bill makes it. That concludes my prepared testimony.
Madam Chair, just so it's clear, driving outside the limits of an occupational license after a DUI conviction is a felony now, correct?
Madam Chair, Mr. Morris, yes, that's absolutely correct. Yeah, if the hardship permit was it was a result of a suspension for DUI, that's a felony.
Thank you. Let us then move to Jack, do you have 21-25? Let's have Catherine up, and I'm going to try to we did get a communication from downstairs that they are in about half an hour worth of work session in the Ag Committee, and then we can get at least one of those members back up. I'd like to have, when we go into the juvenile detention bills, 356, 406, and 562, I'd like to have at least one represent one of those other members here because I think they're important bills. But maybe we can get through the House bills that are very simple, 2125, 2126, and 2355, or go ahead and working with 121, Catherine, whichever is yours.
I had 121 out first. But
she has 121 out. I don't know who's got a major objection, who... If either of the two folks that are down
if I remember correctly, Senator Springer asked for an amendment which inserted the word intentional. You might want to wait for him on that. Or
well, no, I don't. As long as it's that simple, then I think we can go ahead. Let's go ahead and deal with 121 then.
Okay, this is the bill that authorizes, adds to the list of activities that psychologists can be sanctioned for. Obtaining payment through fraud or misrepresentation, and the amendment -1, which should be in your folder, simply inserts the word intentional misrepresentation.
Is that all it does?
We had a lot of debate about whether we ought to add this to the statute, but the folks from that board still feel like it's important to have in their statute since they've already embarked on that road of listing all the things. So I think that was the gist, as I recall it, of their testimony. I know they're probably Senator Grinsky doesn't think that was necessary, if I recall his conversation. But it's here, and
the
board seems to think they want it. So if they've gone through all the trouble, this is and. Do we have an amendment, -1?
-1, which just puts the word intentional in front of misrepresentation.
Madam Chair, I would move the 120 SB 121-1 amendments.
Okay. Senator Hill has moved the amendments. Are there objections?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 121 with both a due pass recommendation. Senator Commissioners Wilkins Elbride. Some discussion.
Just trying to get my head back in there.
Okay, Senator Hill has moved Senate Bill 121 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I have a note to myself here. Consider amending subsection 2 to permit offenses to be established by rule. And I'm just wondering.
Well, that's a major overhaul of their statute, and I guess I'm not prepared to do that right now.
Where did that come up in the testimony?
Yes, that was the question about whether they ought to have all of these enumerations in the statute, in the ORS. In fact, the fact is that they've already embarked down that line. And
no, there they are.
So they're there, and unless we want to...
So we're not going to stop them.
Well, I guess I'm not ready to stop them right now unless
Another laundry list statute.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what it was, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you'll call the roll, please.
Brenneman? Brockman?
Aye.
Brenske?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. 122.
And this is a bill that authorizes the same sanctions against a psychology associate as against the psychologist, and it simply goes through the statute and adds the word associate, psychologist associate.
And if you recall, we had a lot of debate about how many psychologist associates had in fact been registered, and we're talking about a community of six at the moment, but they want the authority as the board to sanction them in the same way. So, are there amendments?
Should it?
No.
Should it include as an amendment the extra grounds that we just passed out?
That would
121. Because I don't think it's included.
Well, it would be legislative council would amend that general statute. I think.
Yeah,
I'm
not
it
sure,
would. Yeah. Are you sure, Ken?
Well, I'm not sure. Why don't we just make sure and move as an amendment that we add as sub...
Don, you want to make a comment on that? You know, is that what we're looking at? Well, they probably don't have a copy of the handbook, so that...
Don Welch, Clackamas County Juvenile Court. Senator, that modification would be entirely consistent with how that language would be implemented.
Could I move then on line 11, remove the words, line 11, page 1 of the Hannah Gross bill, remove for death?
Are there objections to that?
I don't really, I'm sorry, you lost me there. Well, see, the language that we're adding on line
what
2 that's under line 13,
line, yeah.
It says, or any felony crime against persons or property.
But my brackets are bracketing 11, 12, and 13.
Yeah, but what the council said, that line 11 would remain in. In other words, that one bracket on line 11 should be moved down one line.
Oh, okay. I thought his bottom bracket was on line 11. Okay, and you're removing death off of line 11.
Yes, because it's picked up and down there on line 2.
Yeah. Okay.
And in fact, you're going to have to change it to on line 2, you're going to have a B instead of an A because of that, Jack, right?
Dan, C.
That's correct.
See what LC does to this. They do have a C there. Yes.
It's just one they didn't.
Yeah.
So then line 14 becomes C instead of.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Is there objection to Senator Hill's motion to delete or death on line 11 that will remain in the bill? Working from our hand and gross bill without a date for 41189. It's stapled to the LC amendments 41189. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
There was another, according to my notes, another amendment we were going to make on line 7, where can place a child in detention if he's a fugitive from another jurisdiction. I think we're going to change that to state or country so that it wouldn't accommodate just another county.
Well, we took care of that on page 2, line 44, and you may be right that we need to put it up in 7 as well.
Madam Chair, someone objected.
I think that was Madam Chair.
Yes.
I believe it was Judge Harrell that felt that language should remain as it is.
In 7, but he'd agreed we'd change it down here. It's on the second page, Senator Shoemaker, where we had
that
discussion.
Yeah, I don't recall that. All right.
Madam Chair, didn't we just have a hassle on one of those previous bills about conflicting bills about jurisdictions and states and things like that? I mean,
yes, I think that's fine.
I
think that's fine. And Cory, do you want to comment to that? This line seven is appropriate.
Madam Chair, Cory Streisinger, Governor's Legal Counsel. I have in front of me a letter which was submitted, I believe, to the committee from Judge Harrell, who confirms the testimony given by Alan Young at the previous hearing that the word jurisdiction should be left in rather than a substitute made.
Cory, are you needing to comment on the Hannah Gross bill? Do you see anything on the Hannah Gross bill as it stands that you would like to comment on?
Madam Chair, Don Welch had a comment on the insertion of subsections, the new subsection 7 on page 2.
Okay, fine.
The new subsection 7.
That's my little funny amendment on page 2.
This is perhaps remote, but I'm reading an appellant's brief this afternoon in a homicide case, an execution-style killing in our county, where the individual was retained in detention preparatory to a remand hearing while a substantial number of defense motions were heard unsuccessfully, and a significant amount of time was devoted to defense-requested psychiatric and psychological evaluation. I would submit the proposition that you might find 56 days as an absolute cap occasionally inconvenient, uncomfortable. The world will not rise or fall on the issue probably because it's a rarity, but I happen to be reading the brief today and I'm reminded of the case where the kid was in for an extended time, essentially at the request of the child.
I'm not as concerned about the last 28 days as I am about the first 28 days, and that's where we are with it. So I don't have a problem just even extending it twice, or just extending it once and letting it go, because I think there's a good enough cause to deal with it. Cory, you have a suggestion?
Madam Chair, it might be possible to insert language, and I don't have it right. The exact language, but that would say except where at the request of the defense or where in connection with delays requested by the defense.
Well, and that I would just put a period after extended and drop off the other if that's what we're going to do here.
I think that would also solve the problem.
I'm not as concerned about that. I think that's probably, I mean, that really gets at what my concern was. And I mean, once they've reached the 28 days, there's got to be a pretty big reason, I think. And there probably would be reason if you got beyond that, or there's no incentive to kind of keep people there, I would think. And that in those circumstances, you're going to have serious cases that for good reason need to be held. Tom is shaking his head.
Yeah,
he doesn't agree with that. I'd look to the wish of the committee on this one.
He looks like he's chomping at the bit back there.
Come on up.
While he's coming up, do we want to be consistent with the previous bill and make it 30 days?
Well, no. This one, the judge says they need to have it 28.
Okay.
Because these have to do with hearings and judicial working times.
Okay.
And we have to check the 28 out.
All right.
Madam Chairman, Tom English, Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency. I think my concern about this is that if you take the chairman's recommendation, then it effectively becomes no limit at all. The idea, there is no limit now, and this the idea of this section was to create a limit. And there is not always, I hate to tell you this, a good reason. It could be because what do you call a good reason? If you call the protection of the community, no. The accountability of the child, no. It's the fact that the caseworker at CSD hasn't found a placement, or the other kind of bureaucratic kinds of things. And the idea of putting the limit on was to force some of that accountability on the part of the system. So if you put the period there, that I don't think you really need the language, because you effectively, the court can now go ahead and extend it and extend it and extend it. If you want to put a limit, then the purpose of the limit is exactly that, is to force some kinds of decisions to be made in this child's life. And if we're talking about preventing dropouts of school and getting people into retreatment programs, having them languish in detention with no program is guaranteed that that child is going to be a further failure the longer he or she is there. And I think 28 days with an extension of 28 days is very liberal in terms, somebody's not doing their job if they're not making a decision about that child. Whether it's the court with the defense motions or the prosecution or the casework, something's not happening in that child's life.
Right. I guess I agree with you, except that I don't want to be responsible for the particular care of having to turn some child loose, some young person loose who's done a major crime that we need to hold them for. Yes, go ahead.
Am I misunderstanding? I thought this was pre-adjudicated.
It is. But if they have done, as Don Welsh said, a crime that's severe enough that they need to really work through and some other reason, then I suppose I don't want to be responsible for turning somebody loose who would otherwise be guilty. Now, I would assume they'd hurry it up and get it done, and they're not going to let them loose. And that may be what we're after here.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Tori.
Another possibility would be to leave the language as it is, but to add at the end, except under extraordinary circumstances when detention may be continued further.
Jack, you have any suggestions?
Well, the suggestion I would make would be to parallel it to the adult 60-day rule, which provides an exception. Don't have the exact language in my mind, but it's basically if there's a request for an extension on behalf of the defense.
Did we get that?
I could have that.
Can we
rustle
it up now?
Sure, you bet.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would think that would be an appropriate standard. It conforms with the way the adult system works.
Okay.
And adds a lot of clarity.
And frankly, I would hate to tell the defense that they can't have an extension of time because of this provision if they need time to prepare for the adjudicative hearing.
It's gone.
We can go on to the next one. Jack is going to look for some language, and we can see what we're going to add a little clause there, which parallels the adult at the request of the defense and instructions. Okay. Anything else with respect to what we have hand engrossed?
Yeah, I think with regard to the bill itself and the nature of pre-adjudicative detention. And I think I was prepared or trying to support the bill, but I can't at this point. And I think that I would like to remind the committee that it's not comparable to the adult system. We don't admit children to bail in the state. It's not comparable to the adult system. And what state policy has been in the past in the dealing with this issue is to try to offset that by putting a greater burden on the juvenile department of the state to prove that this child needs to be incarcerated. And I don't think this bill does that. This opens that door again back to pre-adjudicative detention, where the intake worker, as a matter of practice, is going to be detaining more and more children. We're going to fill those detention centers up. It's not comparable to the adult system unless we have bail and go through that process. So I don't think we should even talk in those terms. There's a real inequity here. And that's not being dealt with in this measure at all. And I would propose again what I thought would be a very workable solution to the original bill was to take the language in line 28 and move it up to line 7, creating a new A, so there's no less restrictive alternative in that level, and then down in the lower level too, so that the intake worker has to make a finding that there's nothing else I can do with this kid and that they would not show up for a hearing. And that I think that would be a much more equitable kind of thing to do and would place an effective limit on the use of secure custody, denial of someone's liberty for up to 72 hours on the basis of an intake worker on a Friday night. And what I would do is, I'm not going to make a tough decision on a Friday night. that this guy might go out and do another kind of crime. So I'm going to take the safest, most secure kind of decision, and I'm going to lock that kid up. And that's been the history of detention in the state, and I suspect that's what's going to happen. And it's going to impact, I think, real heavily on the, on our juvenile departments and our detention centers, which are now being crowded with delinquent offenders that have been adjudicated. My real concerns with this bill.
Okay. I had a copy of some testimony from, written testimony, I have it out here. Since overlaid it with lots of other issues. Does anyone from the committee want to either respond or ask the people at the witness stand to comment?
I'd love to have somebody respond because I think he's absolutely dead set right.
I'm sure I'm puzzled about something and it probably could be explained very quickly.
Senator Schumer, I'll get to your question.
How does 356, which has a 38-day maximum, relate to 562, which has a 56 or possibly unlimited maximum? I'm sure there's a quick explanation, but I just need to know what it is.
That's my question, to at least put some limit here.
I'm just mechanically. Mechanically,
you
got
some
really
mechanically, Senator Shoemaker. Mechanically, you have a person who, your 562 has to do with how long you can hold someone until you bring them to trial,
juvenile,
or take them to the juvenile court, and decide whether they go to McLaren or they go to an placement, or decide what you're going to do with them. And 356 is a time limit on how much after they've been adjudicated you can keep them in a detention center.
Okay.
And if you look at the fairness question, you're saying here you're allowed to keep someone who is pre-court.
Yeah, you can keep him for 56 days or unlimited,
right,
before he's, quote, tried.
Yeah.
But after that, you can only keep him for a maximum of 38 unless you send him off to McLaren.
Madam Chair.
That explains
it. No,
it's
30
right
total. Yeah.
David. Madam Chair, Senator Schumacher, the 30 days in Senate Bill 356 provide an option which can be used when a juvenile generally is on probation. Basically, it provides a broader range of sanctions for juveniles who are in the community and may commit a probation violation. And, a judge may choose to use 2 days, 5 days, 8 days, or up to 30 days, but it broadens the range of sanctions given that juveniles who are on probation occasionally make mistakes and need a sanction to be reminded that their probation is being taken seriously.
Yeah. I understand the difference. I just had lost the thread that one was pre-adjudication. I'm catching up to where I was the last time I heard this. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I respond to the previous discussion by Mr. English? And this also relates to the language, which I apologize for it being in handwritten form. We thought we had a very clean way to address this issue by simply deleting a couple of words from the bill. We only found out this evening that that wouldn't work. Mr. English has discussed two separate issues. One of them is the issue of what you might call least restrictive alternatives. The other is the issue of preventative detention. This bill permits detention of a juvenile for one of two reasons. Number one, to assure an appearance at a hearing, and number two, to protect the community. It would be possible to have a juvenile who we are sure will in fact appear for a hearing, but will also, we are sure, or we are reasonably sure, commit criminal acts in the meantime. So this allows juveniles to be detained regardless of whether they will appear at a hearing if, under the standards set out here, there is reason to believe that the child's behavior in the interim would endanger the child or the community. Now, and that's one of the issues addressed by Mr. English, whether or not that's an appropriate standard. The second issue that he addressed, however, is what decision-making pattern either the intake officer or the judge needs to go through before making the detention decision. And that's the least restrictive alternatives issue. That is, should the detaining officer or the court say, can we protect the community through some less restrictive means? Can we assure that this juvenile will not commit additional criminal acts before the hearing through some less restrictive means? Clearly, in our view, and I believe in Mr. English's view also, if some less restrictive means can protect the community, that less restrictive means should be used. That is the language which is handwritten, which you see in front of you. It would say that if the court or the intake worker has reasonable cause to believe that other preventative measures, increased security, monitoring, family custody, other conditions, either could be tried or should be tried, that those should be used. Those must be used before detention can be ordered. And as I say, we thought we could handle that through a brief amendment to subsection 3 of the bill, beginning at the bottom of page 1 and extending over to page 2, but we concluded that language, which is the least restrictive alternatives language also, only applies to probation violations, and we concluded that it would be too complicated to try to make it fit both, so we are, in this amendment, we would replicate it and insert it on line 31. That takes care of the least restrictive alternatives issue. It applies the least restrictive alternatives language to both appearance for a hearing and protection of the community. There is a separate policy issue about whether or not you think protection of the community is grounds for detention at all, but the least restrictive alternatives issue is a separate one.
We're now convinced that that fits on line 31 on page 1, your handwritten.
Madam Chair, amendment. Legislative Council may come up with a more graceful place to put it, okay. But it will work this way.
Okay, my only comment was that Tom had suggested something be up front, and I'm wondering whether there's a material difference in where it's placed, and that's my question.
Madam Chair, I believe there is. The language that Tom is suggesting would be to make the language which now appears on lines 28 and 29 govern the whole bill. That there are two things in that language on 28 and 29. Let no means less restrictive of the child's liberty is number one, and then gives reasonable assurance that the child will attend the adjudicative hearing is number two. So if you make that language govern the entire bill, what you're saying is we can't detain the child if any other means will assure that he attends the hearing, even if we think he will commit criminal acts in between.
I thought he included B in that, but maybe
not.
He didn't.
I'll let Mr. English explain his own amendment, but as I understand it, he is suggesting having subsection A there govern the whole bill.
Okay, Tom, you want to respond?
Yes, Madam Chairman. That's exactly what I was proposing, and I'm proposing it for that period of time on the Friday night when the child comes in, they have to make a decision up to 72 hours of whether they can keep that child or not. I don't think you can say that there might be some reasonable cause to believe that this child may go out and commit that crime again. And I think but you don't know. And so what I would suggest is a balance test. And I was more comfortable with when we said, if we're going to do that, and there might be a need for preventative detention, I'm not opposed to it entirely. But let's be really very clear what it's about. Under the current bill as it's being proposed, theft one or going out and doing damage to utility property could be a reason to do that, to hold the child. So I could support preventative detention if we raise the standard for community protection for serious crimes, but not any felony against property or person. That really opens the door. I would go back to a very fine list where I think we can say, okay, we're going to deny this child their liberty for 72 hours because we have some reason to believe there might be some damage, and the cause of the community is the damage to this community is likely to be a serious one. But not for, you know, not open the door where we have it here now. And that's where I'd like to compromise on that issue. There is a need sometimes for preventing detention. But let's make it for the serious kind of crime, where the property, where the child really is in danger or the community is in danger and needs to be protected.
We've had trouble defining what that is over the past years, and I think that's what we're here struggling with.
I agree
with that. I just...
Chairman, Judge Harrell, I think, had a pretty good list on there.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Court.
The language on line 3031, which is the preventive detention language, specifies that the child's behavior has to endanger the physical welfare of the child or another person or endanger the community. So it's not simply that there's reason to believe that any minor offense will be committed in the interim, but rather that the child's behavior will endanger the community and with the language that we're proposing here, no less restrictive means can prevent that danger.
Madam Chair, I just want to add that I feel that the language that we're proposing here greatly mitigates my concerns regarding the preventive detention language. I think that the spirit of what we mean by least restrictive alternatives in terms of community protection is adhered to in this language, and it makes a critical difference. So I think the placement is fine, and I feel comfortable with it there.
I think we still don't have Senator Brockwood's question answered, and people can be taking a shot at it.
Well, no, it's not. I think they've given it their best shot, and I appreciate that and thank them for it. But no, I'm just kind of a little queasy about it right now. So if you want to do something, you should perhaps maybe wait for other members of the committee.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to make sure that, in fact, you had that you felt, since I interjected some thoughts, and that you may have not gotten the most concise answer that you could have, and if you wanted to sort of press forward, I was inviting you.
But No, I appreciate that. No, it's just sort of a gray area for me, and I think we could probably sit here all night, and I'd still be a little fuzzy on where I think it ought to be.
Senator Shoemaker.
In light of the comments that have just come from Mr. English particularly, are you comfortable with subsection 3, begins the bottom of page 1. It looks like a revocation of probation prior to a probation hearing. Nothing more than to protect the best interests of the child or the community.
Madam Chairman?
Again, I'm probably missing something because I'm just getting into this fresh, but it looks, well,
Don Welch, Clackamas County Juvenile Department. That's existing law, 419-598. It's simply been incorporated here, and it was a policy decision that those already within the reach of the court system ought be amenable to more intrusive involvement with the court if it's necessary to arrest their behavior while they're on probation. So this is simply a restatement of what's presently in the statute and another number.
Yeah, I guess it sort of seems to me that it more properly belongs within 356, that is your detention following conviction, if I can use that word, as opposed to detention prior to that. And again, are we mixing the apples and oranges here? Or?
Madam Chairman, Don Welch, if a personal view was that I was not in favor of incorporating that particular language in Senate Bill 562, nor in any other bill. I would have left it as part of 419-598 and left it out of the system, because I agree with you, it is a bit of mixing. There's no damage done by it that I see, but I don't see it as necessary either. There is no substantive change that's intended by its incorporation here.
Well, if everybody's comfortable with that, I don't want to push out of any further.
Mr. English.
One other shot at the preventative detention, because I think we really would like to work it. Why not use the adult standard and then list the specific crimes? And let's, you know, if we want to get it comparable a little bit there, we're not limiting these kids to bail. Let's use the adult standard, the likelihood to commit a violent crime, and then list the crimes. I think that gets a little equity and a little fairness in the situation.
Madam Chairman, I've kept quiet on this issue, and maybe as long as I can. Don Welch, Juvenile Court, Clackamas County. A bit of history. I think it was the 83 session when the significant change in the detention law was made, and essentially what was was predicated on was an anticipation of what everybody expected the U.S. Supreme Court to do in New York case, and that is to say that preventive detention for juveniles is unconstitutional. The reality is that the Supreme Court did not make that declaration. It made precisely the opposite declaration. Shaw versus Martin says that preventive detention is an appropriate response to juvenile behavior. There is no bail. I would argue tangentially, perhaps, that if you want to incorporate bail, that's fine. I think it's an unnecessary nuisance, but if that would satisfy people, that's all right. As a practical matter, the testimony you've heard on the substance of this in the past is that kids who will appear in court often will continue to misconduct themselves in ways which are substantially self-destructive in terms of ultimate plan. And you do have a policy decision that you need to make. I believe the original policy decision was made under a misapprehension about what the Supreme Court was going to do, and it made it simpler. Maybe it's harder at this juncture. I would advocate for the proposition that preventive detention should be available with standards. Standards have been suggested here. The handwritten edition is an elaboration of those standards. And I submit that that's an appropriate policy for the state of Oregon in terms of this juvenile behavior.
Senator Hill. I have to ask, though, when we're talking about doing something that's comparable to the adult standard, I mean, I have to ask, what specifically is the problem with that? I mean,
Don
are
Welch.
Are we talking about being more restrictive than that? I want to know why, if that is the case, why you want to be more restrictive than the adult standard?
Senator, I don't know if I'm being more restrictive, less restrictive, or simply differently restrictive. So I'm not making a substantive argument in terms of what the adult standard is. Kids are not simply small adults, number one. Bail is not available. We use a different standard. We're not in a criminal process. What we're trying to do is to arrest the behavior immediately, and we have a different philosophy at work. It very well may translate into more restrictive. The irony is that in this business, when we were with more, shall we say, broadly stated detention policies, the standard litany complaint about the juvenile court was that the kid was back on the street before the police officer could write his report. You can't have it both ways, but it seems to come with the territory that those kind of complaints are generated. We are talking about a person who has conducted themselves in a way which is self-destructive in a way, in addition to being destructive to the community. It is, by the way, not a 72-hour, but a 24-hour judicial hour standard that we are saying has to be applied by a person in my position until the child gets before a judge. The judge can scrutinize that and, on the basis of the standards that are here, make a decision pending further investigation. I simply come down with the proposition that the juvenile court is not the criminal court. It ought not be. And sometimes it'll be more liberal, sometimes it'll be more restrictive, and I would submit it is simply different.
Well, see, that seems, I hate to say it, but see, that's the problem with this whole area. And I'm sick of it. I can't get a hold of any of it. I mean, it just seems like every time we try to do something, we say, well, it's just different. Well, I'm trying to get it and compare it with something. Now, I know how we treat adults. And when we treat adults a certain way, at least let's have that as a standard. And I need to have some comparison as to why we would treat them more liberal or more more restrictive. Now, if you can do that, and I don't mind doing it, but let's talk about it directly and not just sort of say...